Imagine a Minneapolis so small that on calm days, the roar of St. Anthony Falls could be heard in town, a time when passenger pigeons roosted in neighborhood oak trees in such numbers that they actually were said to have broken the oak branches. Now picture a dapper University of Minnesota professor conducting his ornithology class by streetcar to Lake Harriet for a morning of bird watching. That professor was Thomas Sadler Roberts, born 1858, died 1946, a doctor for three decades, a bird lover virtually from birth, the father of Minnesota ornithology, and the man who, perhaps more than any other, promoted the study of the state's natural history. A love affair with birds is the first full biography of this key figure in Minnesota's past. It was written by Sue Leaf, an acclaimed author on environmental topics and now president of the Wild River Audubon Society of East Central Minnesota. Sue Leaf now joins us here by telephone. Sue, welcome to the Roadhouse.
I am happy to be here.
Thomas Sadler Roberts, how did you come to write his biography?
Well, I tell you, I was working on a project for Audubon, Minnesota, where I was studying birds that were threatened or endangered and were using Audubon's important bird areas as a place of refuge where they could nest and find what they needed to produce young. And I was using Dr. Roberts' The Birds of Minnesota, his two-volume epic book on our state's birds, as a reference point. And I had had the book on my shelf for years, but I had never really looked at the book before. And as I was using it, I thought, first thing I thought was, my gosh, there's an enormous amount of data in this book. I just could not believe all the information he had on each state bird. But then I was also very intrigued because Roberts is a wonderful writer. He shows a real tenderness and a real regard for the small birds. And I just thought, gee, who is this guy? And I was intrigued. And I Googled him. And I found out that he had quite a bit of personal papers and journals that are available to study at the University Archives.
Really? That came up right on Google?
He came up on Google, right.
So, your book is very, very scholarly, and all the footnotes for all of the chapters indicate that you had a lot of interesting sources. Can you tell us a little bit about those sources and how you found them?
Sure, I can. Well, the most important source, especially for the first part of the book, is his bird journals that he started in 1874 when he was 16 years old. His father encouraged him to write down his encounters with birds, the birds he was shooting and collecting for a scholarly collection, and also notes on their habits and their behavior, which he did. And so he amassed quite a good collection and wrote about it, and all those bird journals are in the University Archives, so I used those. And then he was a pack rat, so he saved just about everything.
And, yeah, we were talking about that. How did... Who keeps all that stuff? So he did.
Yeah. He has letters from all sorts of people for 60, 70 years. And his father and mother both kept journals at certain points in their life, so I could draw on those. And as he got older, from about 1926 to 1946, he kept a little pocket calendars in his breast pocket, you know, which told me what his schedule was like every single day for those 20 years.
Wow.
And I could reconstruct his comings and goings from the Bell Museum of Natural History using his journals.
Yeah, and you did a great job of setting the scene, and you know, it's not just a recitation at all of journal entries, but rather a story that really flows really nicely. And it's a fascinating look at early Minnesota and what it was like in the late 19th century.
Well, thank you for saying that.
Yeah, describe a little bit about that. When they first came to Minneapolis, tell us about that.
When they first came, first of all, they couldn't take a railroad across the Mississippi River because there were no bridges, railroad bridges across the Mississippi.
What year was this?
1867.
Okay.
So the state was 9 years old, just like Roberts, and the Civil War had just ended 2 years before, and the Dakota War had been fought, and the Dakota Indians had been displaced from their lands. So in Minnesota, there are two major cities. There's St. Paul, which is the capital city, has a nice capital, domed capital already. But everybody has kind of muddy streets, and nobody has a sewer and waterworks yet. Minneapolis is slow to grow. When the Roberts came in 1867, Minneapolis was smaller than St. Paul, but they liked it better, and they didn't really say why. But I suspect part of the reason was that his father had tuberculosis and had been told to go outside and spend a lot of time outside, and it was easier to get out of town and wander around the rural areas when you're in a smaller town, and Minneapolis is a smaller town.
It struck me as kind of strange to... Where they came from Philadelphia, wasn't it?
They came from Philadelphia, yes. And, actually, they came from Germantown, which is a suburb.
Yeah, okay. And but to come to Minneapolis for the weather was...
I know.
Pretty interesting concept.
That was the common thought on. No one knew what caused tuberculosis at that point.
Sure.
And it was thought that, you know, the grimy, polluted air of the industrial cities of the East were bad for the lungs. Mm-hmm. And if you got out into the fresh air of an unpolluted environment, that you would thrive. And actually, John Roberts, Thomas's father, did live another 20 years, 23 years.
Yeah, I was surprised at that. I mean, it sounded at the beginning like, oh, my, he's on
he
his last legs.
Sick.
But he kept
kept
going. So I guess the Minneapolis open air... did
had
him good.
Some kind of effect. And, you know, Roberts did say in later life that his father was a near invalid for most of his growing up time.
And then you describe his treks out into the wilderness around their home in Minneapolis, all the way out to, let's say, Lake Calhoun or maybe even Lake Minnetonka.
It was pretty strange. Fort Snelling was a destination. And they lived downtown at 1st Avenue North and 8th Street, so kind of where the former Dayton's is in that neighborhood.
Oh, sure.
It was a neighborhood, and the whole developed Minneapolis was below, it's just in the downtown area now. Then they had to go up a cliff area, which is why it's called Uptown, and up by the lake, it was platted farmland. There were a few houses, but it was mostly farmland, but there were large stretches of oak savanna that had not been touched. And the United States government owned the land as part of Fort Snelling to Minnehaha Creek. So that was all oak savanna wild with oak trees and prairie grasses.
Sure. And for the listeners, Sue does a great job of describing this Minneapolis. I mean, all of us probably are quite familiar with them. I mean, I grew up in South Minneapolis, very near Minnehaha Falls, which you describe as being a roaring torrent at that time, based on his journals.
When it rained, it still can be a roaring torrent.
Oh, yes,
torrent.
I know.
Like now, I suppose it is. We've got quite a bit of rain down here.
I want to follow up on his bird journals and this Young Naturalist Society. Tell us a little bit about that.
He had a grade school friend, Clarence Herrick, who was a bright, very bright boy and was as interested in natural history as Roberts was. And together with a third friend, Rob Williams, whose father owned a bookstore downtown Minneapolis, they formed a Young Naturalist Society, and they got a couple other boys, bright boys from the class. And they said they were going to meet. They actually met once a week. They had dues. They had very formal minutes, all of which are on record at the University Archives that you can read.
And these are high school kids,
right? These are high school kids.
Yeah, and they all went on to be, you know, basically have science careers in some respect,
Herrick,
didn't they?
Herrick was brilliant, according to Roberts. And he went on to get a PhD, and I want to say in some aspect of neurology. He actually published a landmark paper on some kind of crustacean in Minnesota when he was 16 or 17. But he died young of tuberculosis. Tuberculosis cut a lot of people down in their youth.
Yep.
The other young man who was the driving force of this natural society went on to become a world expert on mosses and worked for some famous institution that's eluding me right now out in Brooklyn. He moved to New York City.
And of course, Roberts himself, although diverted to a medical career for a number of years, became a very significant naturalist at the University of Minnesota later in his career.
He did teach the first ornithology class in the state,
mm-hmm.
And then was the guiding light behind the Natural History Museum, which was funded by one of his patients, James Ford Bell, and later adopted Bell's name.
And another thing, what I want you to comment on a little bit is what I'll call shotgun ornithology. You referenced it earlier that they would go out and shoot these birds.
Yeah.
Okay. Describe. I mean, that makes you kind of cringe a little bit now.
It does. You know, I have not talked to an audience yet who hasn't just cringed with the idea that Roberts are shooting birds. But and when he started this in the 1870s, no one was using binoculars to look at birds. There weren't any binoculars. And in fact, that idea that you could see a bird through some kind of optics didn't come into vogue until about the 1880s, right, when women, young women, would use their opera glasses to look at birds. The way they looked at birds, well, I think Roberts must have had really good eyesight for one thing, but also they took a gun and shot it and then used some kind of a scholarly book to identify it. It's
sure.
To Minnesota's advantage or benefit that Roberts did shoot what he identified, because we do have those study skins still. He didn't just throw the skins away.
Right. That's the other reason,
right,
for doing this, of course, is so
he
that they
them
could skin them, preserve them, and other people could see them and understand.
Right.
The
and they are
like
in the university collection today. Most of his bird skins are. And in fact, I was just at the university scientific collection on Monday, and they showed me that specimen number one was a Canada warbler put up by Roberts in 1875.
Wow.
When he was 17 years old.
That's amazing that they're still there. I mean,
yep.
I know that when you describe when he set up the ornithology museum or whatever it was, when he came back to the university, he found the specimens were in bad shape.
Yeah.
And he had to restore them. So it's amazing that they're still there.
Well, here's the deal. The legislature set up a requirement that the university house a natural history museum, and they made the director of the animal biology department the curator of that museum. And, of course, a department head has far more things to do than just look at or, you know, take mm-hmm. care of the natural history museum. When Roberts came, he was made associate curator because by state law he couldn't be the curator. But he kind of took it under his wing, and it had been neglected, and so he tossed out specimens that he didn't think would have any educational value to Minnesotans. And did you notice that? I'm not sure it's in the book, but I did later confirm it. One of the things he tossed out was General Custer's pet dog that had been stuffed.
I don't remember that.
I don't think I put that in the book. No. and that is a believable
there,
tidbit.
Yeah.
It's a believable tidbit because Horace Newton Winchell, who was the director at the time, had accompanied Custard on a expedition out to South Dakota. So it's very possible,
really?
He could have gotten,
yeah,
the dog.
Well, then you describe in his youth after high school, he became a land examiner, and he did work for the naturalist surveys for the university and so on. And one of the trips he went on, I mean, he went all over Minnesota. Just,
yep,
amazing to think of that. I mean, they had railroad then and horse and buggy and so on. But to get up to Grand Marais, for example, he came to Grand Marais one summer to do sampling for, I can't remember what.
The Natural History Survey.
Okay.
Under Winchell.
History Survey of Minnesota, yeah.
Yep, he had to come by steamer because, of course, there were no roads from Duluth.
Yeah, and I was wondering if you could, and you include a journal entry, a quote from his journal when he arrived in Grand Marais. If you could set that up a little bit and then just read us that journal entry.
I would love to do that.
Okay, we're talking 1879.
1879, Roberts is 21. He has been out of school a year because he had been suffering from what we think was tuberculosis, and he is now, no, excuse me, he's finished his second year at the University of Minnesota, and he will come down with symptoms that sound like tuberculosis on this expedition. But for right now, he's feeling good, and they have taken the train up to Duluth, and then they had met a steamer that was going to drop them off. The plan was to drop them off 1 mile outside of the Grand Marais Harbor, and then they would row in to Grand Marais and start their survey. Roberts had brought a shotgun. He was going to collect birds, but he was also going to be the botanist and collect plant samples. Okay, so it was a Canadian steamship and with an English captain, and they get dropped off about 10 o'clock at night, and it is July 26th. So there still is some light lingering in the sky, but it's mostly dark, and the plan was they were going to row this mile in. So here's what Roberts wrote in his journal the next day. There was a considerable sea running, but no wind of any account. We started off, Prof. Rybrecht and I pulling. The captain said that he had run within a mile of the coast. As the steamer moved off and disappeared in the distance, we began to feel that we were actually at sea at night on Superior and in a small, heavily loaded boat. Steering by the stars and the dark line of shore, we pulled away steadily, thinking every little bit that we ought to be close to shore. But it was not until 2:30 that we really came to land. The captain deceived us badly. We must have been 6 or 8 miles out in the lake, a rather dangerous position, all things considered, for there is no telling how suddenly storms may arise.
Man, he must have been paddling one of those wooden boats rowing one of those wooden boats that were created at North House up here. I mean, that's pretty amazing story to be dropped off out there.
And they had all their supplies, so it was heavily laden, so they must have been riding pretty close to the water. And then as they approached the shore, none of them had been to Grand Marais before, and there is no town there. There's a couple shacks with the Mayhew brothers.
Right.
And so what they see from the water is mostly these large rocks and the waves crashing on the rocks. Because remember, although there's not a wind, there's still these, you know, how Superior starts rolling and takes a while to settle down. They had a storm earlier that day. So they thought, well, you know, if we go out one way, we're going to get smashed on the water and we won't survive. And so they didn't know which way the harbor was. So they opted to go off to the right, and that was the right choice. And as they came around that point, they saw the natural beach, the natural harbor. And they rowed in, and it was 4:00 in the morning. They were so exhausted that even though it was getting light, Roberts reports that he just fell asleep right there on the sand. And when he woke up, he saw this white-bearded, white-haired, kindly old gentleman staring at him. And it was Thomas Mayhew, one of the few inhabitants of Grand Marais.
Oh, that's pretty interesting for us up here. I mean, there are still other connections even in your book to the north, a lot of to northern Minnesota, but also to Lake Vermilion. And then you talked later about some good friends of his, who an artist who painted the diorama, part of the diorama, Francis Lee Jaques.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they figure prominently in your story of his later years, and they, of course, spent time up at Gunflint Lodge writing one of their book. Yeah,
right. Yeah, and Lee actually went up with Robert's taxidermist, Walter Breckenridge, who will later become the director of the Bell Museum after Roberts.
Right.
They went up together, and Lee would sketch before he came back down to start painting a diorama. There are three dioramas set on the North Shore. There's the Wolf diorama, that was his first one. The Moose diorama, which was he was working at right before Roberts became really ill and died. And then there's also one on Cascade Falls, where Cascade State Park is now. That's
right.
Also at the Bell Museum.
And that's the later part of his life. I mean, we'll just skip over the fact that he served for 30 years as a physician. And actually,
right.
It sounded like he was a physician until the time he died.
He was, right.
But the important contribution here is the Bell Museum and the book he wrote. Tell us, you did describe the book, I guess, but The Birds of Minnesota. It's a two-volume
book. Two-volume book. You can still get it if you look online.
Mm-hmm.
It's still available, and it's a wonderful book.
It's all painting. I mean, the full of drawings, right?
It is.
Of birds.
He was very concerned that every bird in Minnesota be depicted by an illustration, and actually more than one illustration, because of course birds look differently. Males and females might look differently. Young birds look differently than adult birds. And he had many different artists, and he was very, he was a stickler. He was meticulous for detail. So the artists are all very accurate. They had to pass Robert's okay. And some of the birds had to be repainted because Roberts thought they didn't look quite right.
Right. Yeah, I remember some fat warblers or something in there.
Plump, the plump prothonotary warblers. Right. So that's a really wonderful book to have. It's not a field guide. You would never take it out.
I was going to say, it's a lot more detail, too. Plus, it weighs a ton.
Right.
It sounds like they're used to hauling a lot of heavy things around, though, on the field trips they went on.
Well, you know, he was a pioneer wildlife photographer also, and that equipment was very heavy. They had an extra-long tripod to set the camera on because he was often photographing in a marsh. And so, you know, he started out with 3 inches in the mud, and then he had to be at his camera.
Yeah.
And he didn't use film, at least in the 1890s. He used glass plates that had to be hauled back to a dark room. And he could only take 12 at a time, so he had to make sure that he was taking the picture of exactly what he wanted to.
Sure.
Yeah, he must have been quite strong. He wasn't a very big man, but they did haul a lot of gear.
Yeah, he was always well-dressed, too. I mean, the other thing about the book is that in the center, Sue has a number of photographs, basically starting from when Roberts was a child until...
A baby picture.
Yeah, there's even a baby picture.
1859.
And the pictures are great. And you mentioned Walter Breckinridge. You know, I remember that name in connection with the Bell Museum. And, of course, many of us who grew up in Minneapolis went through the Bell Museum as school students. And then, of course, if you went to the university, you went there and looked at the dioramas. And now to learn that those dioramas were created by this same guy.
Yeah. Right.
Thomas Adler Roberts, and Walter Breckinridge was his protege.
Right. It really was. The pictures were really fun. I have a ton of wonderful pictures. The family was most generous.
It must have been hard to choose.
Yeah. And then, but he was, because he was a wildlife photographer, he took a lot of pictures himself, and they are all at the Bell Museum, and most of them had not seen the light of day.
Huh.
And so it was very fun to be able to think about having the rest of Minnesota look at some of these early pictures of Lake Itasca. Marvelous.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, you have a great picture of the family at a picnic in Itasca, where they're all sitting on the ground, of course. There's no picnic
table.
With
their galvanized pail lunch bucket. That was the site of Douglas Lodge.
Oh, really?
Douglas Lodge had not yet been built.
Huh. Well, I tell you what, we could go on talking about this for a long time, but we're talking to Sue Leaf about the book she's written, A Love Affair with Birds, The Life of Thomas Sadler Roberts, which was published in 2013, and that's this year, and is available, I suppose, at most bookstores now. Sue, where would folks go to find this book?
I hope you have an independent bookseller up there, right?
Yep, we do.
I hope that
they could get it, for sure.
They could get it.
Yep.
And you can get it online. And you can get it online at the University of Minnesota Press's website as well.
That's a good point. Right here in Grand Marais, you can go in and order that book, I'm sure, if it's not there already. And it should be, with that great story of Grand Marais.
It would be a good match for a local bookstore.
It is. All right, Sue, thank you very much for joining us. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.